I'm so excited to share with you that the doors are officially open for my first ever phone-free event that's happening in Los Angeles, California on February 28th at Mudwater Gather in Santa Monica, with the option for you to dive even deeper on March 1st. Now look, this event is about you. It's about you building connections and community and us all really bringing this analog revolution to life and reminding our hearts and souls what we truly crave most, what nourishes our being, which is co-regulating with other humans, having our mirror neurons dance together, sharing experiences together, but also learning together. So on top of all the community and connection possibilities for you, there's also an incredible lineup of speakers. I've got internationally renowned nervous system expert Sarah Baldwin, Nike master trainer Brandon Collingsworth talking about purpose and meaning, and Mandy Balak, who's the president of the Gathering Festival, which is one of the largest marketing and branding conferences in North America. So we're going to be diving deeper into what does the future look like to walk alongside technology and use technology as a tool. Now look, if you want to dive even deeper, there's limited space for a VIP dinner on the Saturday night. And if you want to go even deeper, if it's aligned for leaders, coaches, therapists, entrepreneurs, branding, marketing, whoever is called, there's a mastermind on the Sunday morning with even more limited seating. And that's going to be about what does the future look like to create in this world with technology. So if this sounds like something you're interested in, you want to find out more and save your spot, go to markgroves.com/future. I can't wait to see you there. Hello and welcome to the Mark Groves podcast. I mean, the world is officially a shit show. I mean, you might be listening to me and like, duh, thanks, Captain Obvious. And I'm like, yep, but it's got to be stated. It's hard to make sense of what the hell is going on. It's hard to know which way is up. It's hard to know who's telling the truth, who's not. It's just a challenging time, and it causes a lot of anxiety. So if you're experiencing anxiety right now, I'd say, I guess you're paying attention. And we often want to just move away from anxiety, of course, right? We want to claim certainty. And so that causes us to really cling to certain beliefs, which really abolishes any opportunity for discourse. And of course, we see this in so many different ways in any conversation about what's currently occurring in the world. You know, we have so many inconsistencies, and I think that's what's challenging is when you question inconsistencies, you're told basically to shut the fuck up, but like in other ways, like don't be hesitant. Are you an anti-vaxxer? Are you anti-this? Are you a Republican? Are you a Democrat? Are you this? I'm Canadian, but we still get assigned these things, you know, no matter what. And we all have ways of dividing no matter where you live in the world. And our fear doesn't allow us to hear all the information. So, of course, there are viable arguments on every side, but our fear doesn't allow us to be open. And I would argue, and this is supported by a lot of research, that first off, the research shows that the news has been overwhelmingly negative about COVID. The news is always negative, generally, right? Because if it bleeds, it leads, is the thought. And we live in an attention economy. And so, of course, they try to hide and jack our amygdala so that we stay on our devices on the news and we consume, consume, consume. And because we don't have social lives generally, depending where you live in the world right now, we're out and about. We're not out and about. We're watching TV. We're scrolling. And so because of that overwhelming negative information, I think it's pretty safe to make the assumption that any dialogue that opposes that main narrative is immediately shut down. And there are words used to assign to people like that, like anti-vax, anti-this, conspiracy theorist. And the hard part I have about that is, one, like the other day I did a video on my stories where I just said, hey, like, this conversation about vaccine passports is important. It's an important conversation to have. And, you know, I think we head down a very slippery slope when we're trading medical compliance with freedom. And a lot of people say, well, they've always existed to travel to certain countries. And it's like, not to go to a store, not to go to a restaurant, not. So they haven't always existed in most countries. And when I put that story up, I received a message from a friend of mine that said, are you an anti-vaxxer now? And I'm like, gosh, nothing I said in the story had anything to do with that. But that's what we do, is we put people in a box so that we don't have to hear discourse, so that we don't have to be uncomfortable, so that we can elicit shame in them, so they can shut down the conversation and not do any more research or any more speaking. And look at, people got censored for posting about vaccine passports 9 months ago, a year ago, saying it was all going there. Isn't that kind of crazy to you that, one, it was censored and now it's here today? And almost like the narrative's being controlled. That's what happens, is it causes a lot of anxiety within us because you can't deny that that happened, right? So then your body's like, well, wait, they're censoring information that's now true. It's almost like they're controlling information. Like, that's where the body would just naturally go. The mind would naturally go there. And then we shame people for being vaccine hesitant. I mean, if we weren't talking about vaccines and we were just talking about anything, any medical intervention, and I said to you, hey, I'm hesitant about taking this drug that doesn't have long-term data, we'd all go, that's pretty normal. That's a pretty normal feeling to have. So when we say, don't be hesitant, what are you, an anti-vaxxer? We're trying to shut them down. And essentially what we're doing is we're gaslighting them. And gaslighting is denying someone their experience. And so if you feel hesitant or you feel scared or you are uncertain, that's normal. I don't know how anyone could say that's not normal, because if it wasn't about vaccines, it'd be normal. But because it's about that subject, there's something greater going on in that any questioning of it, we've assigned an opportunity to just label someone. And of course, shame shuts people down and then they're not going to share. And actually, it creates inflammation and it has an immune effect as well, which is not positive. And we start to not trust our own feelings, our own thoughts. We're like, oh my gosh, I am hesitant and I can't believe I'm not supposed to be. You can get ashamed. You can get shamed for doing this. And so we're threatened with the possibility of not belonging. And you know, this is a huge conversation. I saw a physician post on their stories, pregnant and getting the vaccine, zero hesitancy. And I was like, I don't understand how that's why you would brag about that. Because that doesn't say to me like, oh, you're a doctor, so you not having hesitancy means there's data there. Nope, data's still not there. So if the data's still not there, and now if I'm someone who's not a physician, and I'm like, but I'm hesitant, well, they're not, so I shouldn't be. Again, we gaslight ourselves. So this happens, and gaslighting happens in lots of emotional experiences. Don't be sad. Don't be upset. You're not supposed to be. That didn't happen. And we question our own realities. So if you have anxiety because your reality has been denied, that makes sense. Breathe into your reality. Your reality's real. Step into it. Own it. Because, you know, we can't help but be curious about what's going on. You walk in a restaurant, you wear a mask, you sit at the table, you take it off. I'm sorry. That doesn't make sense. And we all know it doesn't make sense. So let's just tell the truth. It doesn't make sense. And we could say public health people are doing the best they can. Sure. We're a year into this pandemic, more than that now. And we're still doing the same things we started with, which were officially a test back then because we didn't know. All the pandemic plans that countries had were thrown out the fucking window. And we went with, oh, let's all do this lockdown thing, except for some countries. And now the argument is being made that they're actually doing better than the ones that locked down. And there's now 40 plus studies looking at lockdowns and showing no to minimal benefit and lots of potential harm. And so I'm not a public health official, but my understanding of public health would be that you would take in new information and you would make different decisions with new information. The same conversation about masks, no matter where you sit on it, there's lots of arguments for both sides, and there's lots of data to show that ones that states and countries that don't have mandates are actually performing better. Again, not saying one's right or the other, but there's a lot of conflicting information. And I'm from Canada, and Canada is bananas with how they're handling this. And that could be with regards to whatever your opinion is on the vaccine rollout, but also just this idea that we're going to attempt zero COVID as a strategy, but we're not an island. And so we kind of stay kind of open and kind of stay kind of closed. And it's not working. And we should be taking in new information. We're looking at other states and other places where cases are not skyrocketing and hospitalizations are not skyrocketing and deaths are not skyrocketing. And, you know, it just leads us to kind of wonder, why is there not a public discourse on this conversation? When you dive deeper into the medical literature and the medical conversation of the world of healthcare practitioners, there is quite a dialogue going on. And, you know, I saw a YouTube video where there was a conversation with the governor of Florida with a famous Harvard epidemiologist named Martin Kulldorff, I think is how you say his last name. And then there was a couple other physicians from Stanford on there. And regardless of your political opinion about the governor of Florida, the fact that this was a dialogue that was based on science, and these are not slouches, these are Harvard and Stanford. I mean, come on. These are the people that we say, listen to the science, follow the science. And then we're like, wait, not those ones though. And so YouTube decided to censor that, saying that it was misinformation. And it's like, but wait, aren't those physicians, especially Dr. Kulldorff, I know is highly cited. It's like, isn't misinformation often compared to the information physicians like them provide? I mean, you couldn't make this up. And that likely will cause you, as it does me, some internal conflict of like, what is happening here? This doesn't make sense. And so my body has been saying this from the start, that there's just something up and I don't know what it is. And you got to follow the money, of course. You know, I used to be a pharmaceutical rep. Like, I don't understand how, if it was a person who lied and misrepresented data and made zillions of dollars, and then we found out and they got charged and they paid a fine, we would never let them work in that area again. But with large corporations, they just do that. They lie, they misuse information, they misrepresent it, they sometimes hold it back, and they pay a $1 billion fine, and then they're okay to do the exact same stuff again, and this time we trust them. Without restoration, without any liability, like there's not liability for vaccine use. So one, at least in the countries that I'm aware of, it might be different where you're from. So we can't negate that information that there's a large amount of money, that there's a large amount of money that gets invested into the media. And so the information we get from the media is biased. Of course it's biased. And to deny that is, I don't know how you can. And so I think for me, at least, what's become clear is that it's hard to trust anything. And the fact that censoring is occurring really causes me to be afraid, because censoring of highly trained physicians, we're getting to a bit of a weird point, because there's something about the discussion that someone or some people or a group or the governments don't want us to have or hear. And I just go, why? Because I don't know why. I just know that it's happening. And so I'm going to continue to bravely turn towards this conversation, because I can't look back upon my life and say I didn't face it with curiosity and open dialogue. I didn't let the fear of negative opinion or someone being triggered stop me from exploring what the truth might be. And so I encourage you, no matter what side you sit on any of the arguments or conflicts or whatever it is, that at least you just open yourself up to the possibility of new information that might conflict with something you've heard before. The recognition that usually when a belief is threatened, especially beliefs about this subject matter, it's usually associated with the fear of death or the fear of people we love dying, and that's a very real fear. And can we breathe deeply into the space that the amygdala needs? Can we take a bunch of deep nasal breaths so that we can maybe explore the possibility that there's more to this? And so the last time I explored this was with a physician, and it was one of your favorite podcast episodes. It resonated so much with you. It found a place in your heart. It spoke to the multitudes and the complexity of the human experience, the earth, and all of it intermingled. I am so excited to have Mr. Zach Bush, MD, back on the podcast. And for those of you that don't know, Dr. Zach is a physician specializing in internal medicine, endocrinology, and hospice care. He's an internationally recognized educator and thought leader on the microbiome as it relates to health, disease, and food systems. Dr. Zach founded Seraphic Group and the nonprofit Farmer's Footprint to develop root cause solutions for human and ecological health. His passion for education reaches across many disciplines, including topics such as the role of soil and water ecosystems in human genomics, immunity, and gut-brain health. His education has highlighted the need for a radical departure from chemical farming and pharmacy, and his ongoing efforts are providing a path for consumers, farmers, and mega industries to work together for a healthy future for people and planet. Actually, before we get started, hold on, I just want to preface this episode with two things. One is you might hear things that you don't like, that make you upset. And I would invite the inquiry into, just because it makes us upset doesn't make it not true. And so are we uncomfortable with truths that destabilize us? Of course we are. But so often we get angry at it and want to deny it and make it go away instead of actually turning towards it and asking how that might change how we need to show up and all the things. And the second thing is just to remind you how magical of a being you are. Just like how magical your body is, your mind, that you can change it, that you can shift it, that you can adjust, that your body can heal, that it's this magical creation. And I think we should all just remember that, how miraculous this experience of being on this planet is, and that we even get to have these conversations and hear them and think about them and feel about them. And so let's do this. Welcome, Dr. Zach. Well, Dr. Zach, it is absolute pleasure to have you back on the podcast. Thank you for making the time.
Mark, pleasure to be back with you and the whole audience here.
Oh, your last episode, and if you're listening and you're like, what last episode? It was, I think it's the most popular episode I've had in recent times. So you clearly spoke to a part of people that they really needed to hear that was different than the sort of fear-mongering narrative that we continue to hear from the media.
Yeah, I think that the human spirit is in need of a new platform to rest on, and that is fear-free and guilt-free ultimately as well. And just a spirit of hope is a good one for us to engender in one another as we move forward here.
Yeah, because it seems like there is sort of an absence of that. I was reading a study recently that the bias of American media especially, but this is true of media worldwide, was if there was any data or information shared about the COVID situation, the coronavirus, it was negative. So even if there was positive news, it was not delivered or not delivered in a positive note. And I just think of like how much that might affect the immune system itself.
Yeah, it's huge, actually. We have long known that the amount of cortisol, for example, a stress hormone produced by the adrenal glands, when produced in a non-physiologic fashion, meaning that it's not kind of your normal anabolic, you know, building constructive input that the adrenals do every day, but shifts to this kind of fight or flight reactive biology, there's an immediate shift in your immune system. And no longer are you concerned about, you know, whether or not you get a virus or whether or not you have cancer in 10 years, your whole reality of the body shifts to a very short-sighted, you know, myopic look at what do I need to do today. And so when you move from a longevity kind of vitality mindset of the physiology to one of damage control and short-term reactivities to make sure that the lion doesn't bite your head off today, you make much different decisions at the biologic level. You push resources to very finite short-term projects rather than looking at the bigger picture of like, boy, I should really be prepared to, you know, replace my pulmonary respiratory axis every, you know, 2 to 3 weeks because you're not thinking about that. And so all of your resources instead move into something reactive. And so we have this huge, huge dampening effect when it comes to fear. And it has a trickle-down effect. And so when your cortisol axis gets kind of inverted on its head, and you start spiking cortisol at 5 p.m., 7 p.m., 9 p.m. at night when you're watching the evening news because there's 100,000 new deaths being reported or whatever it is, and you start to get your body into that fight or flight state before going into sleep, you never get stage four sleep. You never get that restorative deep sleep that goes and builds your immune system. And so there's an immediate impact of fear on the immune system and your innate capacity for vitality. And then there's these trickle-down effects through poor sleep quality, poor sex drive. And it starts to stack up from an endocrine standpoint to this real crisis of vitality.
Well, there seems to be there seems to have been a real absence of any sort of, hey, build your immune system, take vitamin D, get some exercise. Instead, it's been be afraid, hide inside, not to mention the psychological impacts of that, wear a mask, hide yourself. Like, everything is not about promoting health generative behaviors. And, you know, that I'm sure as a physician observing that, like, I'm curious, like, I've heard from a number of physicians that concern, but I've also seen censorship of these kinds of conversations that are about health promoting behaviors.
It's an astounding decision that, you know, the common narrative decided to take the tack they did, you know, like to create this vision, this fearful vision that we're in the first global pandemic since 1917. It's going to be like the Spanish flu all over again. And if mortality is going to be 30 times worse than flu. Those were the first, you know, that's the first 8 weeks. That's March, April last year, you know. Mm-hmm. And so you take that narrative, and then anybody who has a positive note of, hey, by the way, nobody over the age of 80 or under the age of 80 died in Northern Italy. Like, you know, it's only extremely elderly people with lots of comorbidities that are dying in Northern Italy. If we had just taken that tack, which was being said, but it wasn't allowed to integrate into the common narrative, you know, so physicians were saying it, scientists were saying it, we were all recognizing that, wow, this does not seem to be a typical pandemic, which typically hits children in Africa. Like, children in Africa, we lose, you know, logarithmically more, you know, people to respiratory disease in Africa every year than anywhere else in the world. And most of it's through pneumonia, which is, you know, might start as a virus, but is microbial, bacterial in its, you know, mortality. And that's because of malnutrition. But here we were watching this thing sweep across the globe, and the children in Africa weren't that wasn't the low-hanging fruit for this syndrome. We were seeing it really consistently hitting elderly, and if younger than 80, it was somebody with really rapid aging morbidities, right? And so we can call things diabetes, we can call them heart disease, we can call them chronic kidney disease, but really those are all just nuances of rapid aging. And so the biology is 80 years old, whether it's a 60-year-old with diabetes and end-stage disease or not. So whether it's a young person or old person chronologically, what we saw over and over again with this recent pandemic is it was always affecting people who were biologically old or biologically failing in the repair process that's innate to youth or vitality. And so that would tells you immediately about a lot of things that you can proactively do for a population to make a population younger. We know a lot of how to do that. We don't talk about it much in Western medicine because we're so busy doing damage control for chronic disease management. But they're really cool things that we can do for anybody of any age. One of the hormones that's most vital to your innate immune system is vitamin D. And so vitamin D is this super unique steroid hormone. It's not actually a vitamin. It was misnamed a vitamin back in the day when we didn't really understand what these molecules were. It's not actually a vitamin at all. Vitamins and minerals come from our nutritional environment, blah, blah, blah. Vitamin D is a steroid hormone made by your skin when it's hit by vitamin D. When it's hit by sunshine. So sunshine hits the skin. Skin produces vitamin D. The vitamin D interacts on 2,000 different genes, which is a full 10% of the human genome. And so it hits 2,000 different gene pathways to modify your immune response. And interestingly, your anabolic muscle build, your lean muscle mass, which then determines your insulin resistance level, all of these things. And so there's this beautiful downstream effect of vitamin D. So knowing that we can youthify the biology, even to people who are postmenopausal or, you know, in that second phase of life where testosterone, estrogen, all these are starting to decline, we can do the same anabolic work with vitamin D that testosterone would typically do, that estradiol would typically do. We can do a lot of that work, a lot of that pro-immunity, pro-health kind of strengthening, lower insulin levels, better kidney function with vitamin D. And so if we had immediately said, we need to get the whole population outside. So this is, you know, February, March last year, which is at our lowest vitamin D points as a population in the Northern Hemisphere, we should have said, all right, everybody jump on 10,000 units a day of vitamin D. And then as soon as April 1 hits, which is the end of solar winter in the Northern Hemisphere, we need everybody outside midday between the hours of 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. for at least 20 to 30 minutes with a lot of skin exposed. Instead, we said, everybody go inside, don't come out because something's going to kill you. And so we literally did the opposite thing when it comes to public health. At the same time, this is, you know, January, we get the first ripples of, oh, geez, there's a new coronavirus coming out of China that might have high mortality. Maybe it has some scary potential. We should have immediately, as of January, stopped all flu vaccines because we had already established that influenza vaccines, when given, increase your risk of coronavirus mortality in the following year. So we should have immediately cessated all flu vaccines. We should have said, look, flu is here, but it doesn't look nearly as deadly as coronavirus. We're going to, you know, forgo flu virus vaccines for the next 3 years until this coronavirus is gone. Then we'll go back and see if it makes relevance idea to put flu vaccines back in play, depending on what the ecosystem looks like at that point. But, you know, studies in 2006, 2012, 2017, U.S. studies, you know, the 2017 was done in the U.S. military, showing again and again that flu vaccine increases coronavirus, you know, infection and death the following year. So load everybody on vitamin D, stop flu vaccines. That should have been by, you know, February 20th last year, before any lockdowns, everything else. We should have already intervened there. Then we should have said, what are the other things that we can do to the population to shift this? And immediately the big ones are sleep hygiene. And so we should have said, all right, we're going to actually stop broadcasting. We're going to have Netflix turn off all content at 10 p.m. because we got to have this population. If we're going to prevent massive death in our country, we need everybody asleep by 10 p.m. We could have done that. That's actually super easy. We could have easily said, we're going to shift content and we're going to do this and there. Next thing we're going to do is we're going to make sure all events are outside. And so all restaurants are not going to close down. They're going to put everybody outside and they're going to move to a regenerative mandate where they need to put on their menu which are the food items that are going to deliver the highest levels of vitamin C and critical nutrients for the innate immune system. And we're going to rank each menu as to when you're outside, getting your vitamin D, eating at the restaurant with your friends and relatives, what are the foods that are going to most support your innate immune system? Like that could have been a really interesting approach. And then we would have left the pandemic with a whole different way to educate people about food. Rather than saying there's 300 calories in your Starbucks, we could say there's zero antioxidants in your Starbucks. But if you go over here and you drink green tea latte with, you know, with almond milk or coconut milk or whatever it is, then you're getting some antioxidant in there. You got some fat that's going to help out. You're getting this many, you know, innate immune system building blocks over here on your green tea, you know. So there would have been so many ways we could have pivoted. And interestingly, some countries decided to do that. And so we saw, you know, Sweden kind of took the, we're not going to do anything mode. We're going to keep everybody doing the smart thing. If you're sick, keep doing what you're doing, but do it at home, you know, whatever it is. But they took the no fear approach and they had some great outcomes. But what was much more interesting to me is what some provinces in northern India did. One state there in northern India, population of 30 million people, as soon as they saw this thing hit northern Italy and all that at the beginning of the pandemic, they said, all right, we need immediately to move on this. So there's a homeopathic regimen that's very specific to viral syndromes. And so they dispersed door to door, province of 30 million people, went door to door throughout the communities with the public health message of, we are now distributing this homeopathy free, and we recommend, you know, vitamin D and exercise every day outdoors. They had 1/60th of the death rate from this. This is a country, this is a state that has no hospitals, no ICUs, there's impoverished personnel, 1/60th of the mortality of New York City, blah, blah, blah. And so that proactive stance of, hey, don't worry, we've got this, we've got a plan, and our plan is to make you healthier, and here's how we're going to do it, and we're going to provide it for free for you because we don't have the hospital infrastructure to help you on the back end of this thing. We need to keep you healthy. And so they were incentivized because of the lack of infrastructure to do the right thing. The second time around, you know, coronavirus now kind of taking its toll, even after all things are done, and now the pandemic's going away everywhere, right? The pandemic's going away, and it had to go away because every single coronavirus pandemic that we've had, SARS, MERS, SARS-CoV-2, these all have a two-year lifespan. And so we probably talked about it last time, but the government was rushing to get this thing out, this vaccine program out, because if they hadn't gotten out in January, the thing would have obviously gone away before the vaccine. So they need to give the appearance that this vaccine is going to play some role in making this thing go away. I talked about this last year in March, April, May. Like, I was, every podcast I was on, I kept saying, do not be fooled by this. You know, so I had no idea what they were going to come up with. All I knew is they had to come up with it fast, and they were going to have to deploy it before, you know, March of 2021, because things are going to be going away. The pandemic will be over. And the reason why they go away every time is because the entire population of biology, and I'm not even talking humans, I'm talking about all the mammals, but further than that, the bacteria themselves that do a lot of the transfer of genetic information from the virome to, you know, multicellular organisms, the bacteriophage and the viruses are going to get bored with this new information, and they're going to come onto a new status of swapping this new coronavirus, you know, whatever it is, and it's going to become stable in the genomic code of the planet. Plants, animals, bacteria, fungi, they all come to a balanced state with the new genetic information within that 2-year period. It always has to happen. That it's been going on for billions of years since the viruses literally date back 3.5 billion years. We showed up 200,000 years ago. It's not humans that cause viruses. It's not humans that fly on an airplane to move a virus. Viruses have been moving around the planet since the beginning of life on Earth, and that's how life has developed. The viruses are literally the engaged language of biology. It's not the abstract language that I'm using right now to try to represent a reality with my words. It is the reality.
Yeah.
The genomic language of the virome is the reality of life on Earth. And so now in 2020, we decide there's this huge pandemic and we're going to put ourselves in opposition to the virome as a whole. That is insanity. That's literally saying, you know, if you had somebody run for politics right now and their platform they were running on is we are going to fire every governmental official here and we're going to give no money back to Americans and we're only going to take your money. That's the new platform. Mm. Nobody would vote for that.
No.
And yet here we are on the platform of life. And as a species, we're saying, here's our new platform. We're going to kill all life around us. We're going to put our immune systems in opposition to the very language of adaptation and biodiversification on the planet. We're going to put ourselves in absolute opposition to it. We're going to genetically modify our species not to be able to handle the input of all of the coronaviruses, which have been integrated into the human biology for, we can date it back 780 years. You know, we can show that humans have been integrating coronaviruses into our genome for 780 years. I'm sure it's long before that, but it gets more and more difficult as we go back in time. But this is not new genomic information. And our planet and our species have been evolving within this new maturing genomic pool over time. And so now in 2020, for the first time, we put ourselves in blatant opposition by genetically modifying our immune systems to react to a single protein, not to the viral genome, not to the intelligence of this thing, not to all the protein, to single protein, the spike protein that's covering. And we have no idea what the ramifications of that is, but I can tell you at the big broad level is we just put ourselves in opposition to a very intelligent genomic language. That has built the environment that has allowed for mammals to occur. And we can talk more about that if you want, as to like how much of the genome is viral and all of that. But at a big level, what a startling year we've had.
Yeah.
For the first time, we've put ourselves in opposition to the language of God, to the language of biology, to the language of the universe, to the language of life itself. We have chosen to genetically modify ourselves against it.
Seems like just a furthering of the arrogance that human consciousness can have, that we are somehow separate from this whole process rather than part of the process, that we can play God over the process rather than recognize that it only takes a small event, which is cataclysmically large to the human race. And you said on the last time we did the podcast that, you know, we're sort of on the edge of extinction as a species, like we're showing the signs of going that way. And you know, what you said about the timing of when the vaccine gets rolled out versus the endemic sort of transformation that coronavirus is going through, like where it's starting to calmed down and the deaths and hospitalizations are going down. I'm sure there are certain number nuances around the world. But what I've noticed being Canadian, you know, paying attention to the data, it's like they're in rapid lockdowns because of case numbers, but deaths and hospitalizations are not following it. And I'm like, why are people not awake to this? And also, because I haven't had anyone on here speak specifically to this, can you speak to the test and why it can be so misleading? Just like give some people an understanding of it.
Yeah. So PCR at its development, every single insert that you find on a polymerase chain reaction assay, which is this PCR assay that we've been using to document this pandemic, says right on it, you cannot use this to diagnose a condition, a clinical condition. Is not a diagnostic tool. And yet here we are rushing around the world using this tool all over the place. You know, for me to get on an airplane right now to get home, I have to stick the swab up my nose and have somebody do this test that on the black box of it says, this is not a diagnostic tool. So why is it not a diagnostic tool?
People would think we're crazy. Sorry, I just have to say, like any other time we'd all be like, why are you doing that? Like, why are we not paying attention to the disclaimer on the box? Sorry, I just have to say that.
And, you know, the guy who developed the PCR for coronavirus was so vociferous about, you know, that this is not a diagnostic tool, should never be used as a diagnostic tool. He got interviewed just months before the pandemic and said, you know, PCR should never be used for this. And the reason he was being interviewed is the World Health Organization, the CDC, and the NIH had staged a pandemic. In 2019, they went through the whole exercise, got all of the governmental, pseudo-governmental agencies together and said, all right, how are we going to react to a global pandemic? What are the actions we're going to take collectively? So they did this whole war games kind of thing that played out over the course of 2019 and leading into 2020 there. Started late 2018, went all the way through 2019, wrapped up in like October. And so they ran the whole exercise. And as part of that exercise, they had decided to deploy PCR as the global test to do this, you know, highly sensitive analysis of who has this virus as carriers and blah, blah, blah. And we want to catch the carriers who, you know, aren't necessarily having any symptoms. And so they had this whole rationale. So in reaction to that, the inventor of the PCR for coronavirus said, this could never work for coronavirus or any other respiratory-borne virus. Interviewed that. Those videos have been around, all of that. He died of, you know, a sudden death, you know, just months before this pandemic, which if of natural causes, that's the worst accident that could have happened to humanity this year. I really feel like we could have had a different course of the narrative if he had still been here in December of 2019.
Odd timing.
When this thing began. And so, again, I don't know that that's a conspiracy. Maybe it's just, you know, human, maybe it's our human karma didn't deserve an easy out. We had to walk this tough path that we've walked here, but really tragic that we lost him. He was still a young scientist. He was brilliant and really had the opportunity to really change, I think, the course of public health and how we understand it. So why can't we use PCR as a diagnostic test? The reason is because it has nothing to do with the clinical presentation or a measurement of the balance of your innate immune system with this virus. All it does is it amplifies any DNA that has entered your system from a coronavirus. Keep in mind, we have lots and lots of coronaviruses in our system that make lots and lots of different proteins. And you're typically looking for just a few of the DNA fragments with this PCR that it would be notorious of this specific coronavirus. But you have a lot of proteins that can that are coded by different DNA strands that could cross-react here. And so different DNA could start to overlap in its reactivity. And so you have poor specificity for SARS-CoV-2 when you start doing PCR. There's a high false positive rate. And right, you know, I showed this publication, everything else before it got taken down back in February last year. The publication got done showing the false positive rate for this PCR that was the leading one at the time, had an 80% false positive rate, meaning that if the tested it was positive, if you retest that person or you actually do an antibody test 3-6 weeks later, 80% of those never had any evidence that they ever had coronavirus in their system and blah, blah, blah. So 80% false positive.
Wow.
That has been taken down. That got taken down quickly early on in the pandemic. And then we got news that maybe it had a 10% false positive, but we've never seen the data to support that number. what the data they loved reporting is that in that same study that said that there was 80% false positive, there was also a 30% false negative, meaning that people that were presenting with coronavirus respiratory disorders were testing negative for it by 30%. And they loved that statistic because they could then multiply any number of positive tests by another 30% and say, that's the real number, you know? So we cherry picked the data, which we tend to do as scientists, and this is why placebo-controlled trials and all of these things are so critical, is we tend to subconsciously, if not consciously, cherry pick the data to tell the narrative that we want to tell. But unfortunately, almost immediately, there was this weird tie-up of the pharmaceutical companies with the WHO, with central banks pumping money into these things and saying that they would print, the Fed came out almost immediately in March and said, we'll print $2 trillion right now, we'll shut down the economy, we're going to give $500 billion to the pharmaceutical companies immediately, just give it to them to go develop vaccines as fast as they can. We expect nothing back from that other than your best effort. And so we gave $500 billion to the pharmaceutical companies, carte blanche, just said, go do whatever you can with it. And so that was our reactivity, at that time frame. And so our mindset quickly became that these vaccines were going to be our salvation. And this is how this pandemic was going to end. And nobody, ever talked about in that common narrative from Dr. Fauci or anything else, the natural history of coronaviruses and how they spread and how they resolve and how the innate immune system adapts to them and how our genome adapts to them. And probably for the good, because a lot of those data that were showing that, flu vaccine would increase coronavirus infection and echovirus and other adenovirus, other respiratory viruses. In those same studies, we found out that if people actually got flu, they were actually had a much less likelihood of getting coronavirus the next
versus
year.
Versus the vaccine. Wow.
And so, this is a well-known phenomenon that when somebody is exposed to a wild type virus and all of its complexity, we actually improve immunity to a vast number of organ, viral inputs the following year. And so we have this adaptive capacity where one respiratory experience can then prepare us for the next year and the year after and the year after. But if we interrupt that natural experience with flu with a vaccine, not only do we lose that kind of broader coverage and intelligence of the immune system, we actually elevate the risk of these other viruses hitting us. So it's very antithetical that we keep chasing one virus with the belief that we're going to change anything. So now we take a look at this current thing, situation where we cannot actually call any of these things, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, I don't care which company you go after right now, and the ones that are currently in development or the ones that are already on the market, none of them can be called a vaccine in the current and traditional definition of a vaccine. All of these are genetic modifications of the organism. So they are all GMO vectors. None of them have anything to do with, giving a portion of the virus or anything like that. It's literally, we're going to force your genome to start making, your cells need to start making viral proteins. So it's a genetic modification of the organism, exactly the same way we genetically modified corn to handle Roundup. We're now genetically modifying humans
to
handle a spike protein. And so instead of, and they can't handle coronavirus, we have no evidence of that. What we can say is they now have an antibody to the spike protein. And we have no idea what that does. And they're pretty honest about that, which I give them a little bit of credit for, which is at least they're obeying the rule of the law that says, we want you to get this vaccine, but by the way, we have no idea if it's safe or effective.
That makes
don't know
no
if it
sense
will
to me.
Decrease your carrier rate. We don't know if it will decrease this. And that's honest. The same thing with flu vaccine. We have no idea if flu vaccine helps anybody. It certainly has never decreased the number of flu cases. What it tends to do is decrease by about 6 hours the length of time that you have flu symptoms. And so the flu vaccine, again and again, can show a slight decrease in the duration of symptoms in some populations, age, demographics, comorbidities, and the rest. But as a population, flu vaccine doesn't change the natural history of flu. It infects everybody who it would have infected otherwise. At best, it slightly modifies their reaction to that experience of having the flu. But it's never been published that flu vaccine actually decreases the number of flu cases. Doesn't happen. In the same way, they're already saying, this is not going to decrease the number of coronavirus cases. It's not how this thing works. We are hoping that it decreases the amount of flu-like symptoms to coronavirus, the aches, the fever, maybe downstream hospitalizations, all of that. But in the only study that allowed us as scientists to see their data, it took 20,000 vaccines to prevent 2 hospitalizations from coronavirus. Unfortunately, in the same study, there was 2 hospitalizations in the first week for severe reactions to the vaccine itself. And so there was zero benefit from a hospitalization, morbidity, mortality standpoint for the vaccine with 20,000 vaccines given. And yet they put it on the market because the absolute or the relative risk of having fever or otherwise went down by a percentage. And so they said, okay, so we decreased the amount of fever in this population. Therefore, we're going to put this vaccine on the market. We don't know what the long-term consequences are. We're sure that it doesn't, you know, decrease the number of coronavirus cases. We hope that it decreases the amount of symptoms to those in those cases, or at least to a portion of the people who get that. But then if we look at what, you know, the reaction is to things, we're vaccinating largely the wrong people, right? And so we're largely vaccinating, you know, the first mandates that we're seeing come out are now around university students. So a couple of universities have come out and said, you have to have this, you know, vaccine before you can come back to school in the fall. Well, that's not the population that has any symptoms that would cause hospitalization in the first place. I worked with Gonzaga University last fall. The very first U.S. university to get their entire student body back to school was Gonzaga there. And at Gonzaga Prep and Gonzaga, they got 4,700 students back last fall in the midst of this pandemic. And those 4,700 students went through, they only had like 110 confirmed cases of coronavirus in the 4,700 students over that first semester. And there was zero hospitalizations. And there was zero, you know, long-term symptoms from those 110 cases. And zero of those 110 cases were obtained through classroom contact or other school events. They were all able to be traced back to home contact, residential contact, or in a couple cases, like weekend parties that were, you know, off campus, and there was the, you know, all of the classic risk factors: no sleep, tons of alcohol, lots of bodily fluids being swapped, you know. And so there was like, you know, half a dozen cases or something that came from one of these parties, but otherwise it was all residential. So the vast majority is residential, meaning that you have to live with the person for a long period of time, have a very prolonged exposure to this coronavirus before you're even going to contract it. And so now we have, you know, a very nice 4,700 college students is a huge case study, you know. And so you've got a great case study saying we don't need to vaccinate college kids because they literally don't end up in the hospital from this thing. That's not who we should be vaccinating, especially because they are the ones that with the most robust immune system that when they see that spike protein genetic modification, they're the most likely to prevent the most feared complication of what these genetic modification previous RNA fragment vaccines have been done, like SARS and MERS. We tried to do RNA for that. We've done other RNA viruses. And every time we do that, we create in about 10% of the people this very frightening phenomenon of hyperandrogen state, where it hypersensitizes your immune system to seeing that wild type virus in the future. And when you see that, you go into something called cytokine storm, which then ends you up in multi-organ failure and high potential for death. And so if even 1% did that, that'd be terrifying. But 10% of a population that's asymptomatic already on a diminishing pandemic that is going to be gone no matter what in 2022, no matter what we do, and we now sensitize everybody to coronavirus or any other virus that carries a similar spike protein, and we see even 0.1% of those vaccinated have this hyperandrogen state, we are going to create chaos. And the scary thing is, if we keep using PCR to detect tiny fragments of virus, we're going to blame coronavirus. We're going to say, coronavirus just killed that person. We need to vaccinate everybody again. No, it wasn't coronavirus. Coronavirus was natural in the environment, barely touched this person, but their immune system overreacted because they got vaccinated in 2020, 2021. And now they're going to perpetuate the fear of coronavirus by the fact that they're actually sensitizing the population, or a very small percentage of that population, to this virus. And they'll be able to tell us horrific stories from here on to the end of time that coronavirus is this bad killer of young people. Because I guarantee you in 2022, the ones that are going to die are not going to be 80-year-olds. We're going to suddenly see 18-year-olds, 24-year-olds, 30-year-olds dying of coronavirus, quote unquote, because they're actually in a totally adaptive immune crisis where their immune system is killing them. They're going to these cytokine storms and dying of multi-organ failure because of the sensitization that happens with all of the RNA viruses that we've tried. And there was hypersensitization already documented in that Pfizer and other ones at the beginning of this process. So it's already been showing that this GMO approach to vaccination can create hypersensitivity or hyperantigen status, just as the true RNA vaccines have done in the past. So we're setting ourselves up for a perpetual crisis that we're going to keep relying on coronavirus, because we're going to keep doing PCR. We're going to keep in this, you know, lockstep, and we're going to be told every few months that there's a new variant of some coronavirus, or somebody will come up with an adenovirus next, threatening the planet. We need a new GMO update. And so we're going to line up for genetic modification over and over again in a species and perpetuate the belief in this as we hypersensitize a small portion of those people that get a vaccine to those natural wild viruses in the future.
Yeah, I'm curious that you just mentioned, and all of that, by the way, is sad and scary and not spoken about unless, you know, like I've done the research, I've listened to you speak, I listen to other physicians speak before their stuff gets censored, where they're talking about these types of things. And like, it scares me on many levels as a former pharmaceutical rep too, of like looking at, you know, I know the inner workings, the relationships. I'm just like, this should be top of mind, this type of fear, especially because I have you on a podcast last year saying it's going to, the pandemic is going to go away in 2 years, all coronaviruses last 2 years. Like we knew all this stuff, like scientists knew all this stuff. And even the pandemic plan of like, hey, this is our pandemic plan. Those all went out the damn window and we all locked down and put masks on our face, which we also said don't work. And then all of a sudden they magically work. And any study that shows they might not is like, let's censor that. Like I'm angry about it, because how do you get this information if I'm not interviewing you or you're not on another podcast? Because you certainly can't go put a YouTube video up chatting about this.
No, it's interesting, you know, and the White House just announced that it's launching, I can't remember if it was $10 billion or insane amount of dollars being poured to a vaccine. How did they phrase it? It was so scary the way that it was phrased, but basically a vaccine belief support program. And so they were going to launch billions of dollars of commercials and everything else to make the population feel good about vaccines. And so that's
it's a gaslighting campaign.
And so the new White House is spending billions of dollars. So the answer is nobody's going to be able to get this information over a short period of time, because there's billions of dollars against, I don't know what your production cost for this podcast, but I'm guessing it's well south of $10 billion. So,
you
have so little dollars to get this information out there. And so I launched the Global Health Education Summit monthly last year in the midst of the thing. I realized we have to have a forum for real science to be discussed. And people need long form discussion. They need long form education, because it's not enough for me to give them a soundbite of masks don't work, blah, 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 because there's too much of the other voice. And so the other voice just keeps repeating itself. Masks work, masks work, masks work, masks work. And they don't show any science. They don't show anything. They just repeat the narrative. And that's their approach. And so I realized I need to spend time educating the population so they can make an informed decision about everything, not forget about the pandemic. I want people to start making informed decisions about taking a statin drug for their heart disease or not. Like, they're not given that information before they're thrown on these drugs. They don't realize that drug actually increases their rate of coronavirus death. They don't realize that an ACE inhibitor that they were put on for their blood pressure or their kidney disease increases their risk of coronavirus death. We have to start at the very beginning of biology and teach it to the consumer now, because the consumer can no longer rely on its regulatory agencies that have been compromised by getting in bed with these pharmaceutical industries at large. So we have a crisis on our hands. We have a crisis of information. We have a crisis of a public narrative that is being reinforced, not just by the White House's multi-billion-dollar effort, but by a multi-trillion-dollar effort of the global media, right? And so you start to add up the entire media budget for the world, the Time Warners and everything else, and you realize, wow, there are nation states that can't even touch that kind of budget for their entire national function, you know, and that's being poured into a single narrative. Any channel, any time of day is going to tell you where coronavirus is, how many people are cases, what the current lockdown is. We are dedicating some, you know, it must be an obscene number. I'd be interested to see the number. It must be, you know, what is it, 60-80% of all media right now in regards to news is being dedicated to this one narrative. And so that is the ultimate brainwashing. We've never seen a bigger media campaign in the history of mankind. You know, nothing that well funded, nothing that well coordinated.
Right.
The fact that you can see that hear the exact same report on the street in France as you can in the United States, as you can in Brazil, the coordination of this multinational media conglomerate has never been achieved before. And so for the first time, we have this situation of a medical complex that is now blending itself with a military complex. So we have a military medical complex that is allowing for National Guard to come in and vaccinate children before the pandemic. You know, California signed legislation that said the National Guard could actually remove a child from the home if their parents were refusing to vaccinate that child. And so that's been on the books for years in California. So, you know, we've allowed for this slippery slope of the military medical complex to come to be a reality. And the pandemic, I think, was the opportunity for it to become a global control rather than a U.S. national control issue. And so the U.S. exported its pharmaceutical military complex to the world through this incredible narrative of the pandemic.
How do you feel like when you're speaking to your colleagues, what is the sort of consensus or temperature for, because you speak out and share, you know, all of your stuff is supported by data. And, you know, like how do your colleagues feel watching the censorship of, you know, each of you when you speak out? And like, it really, I mean, it takes away any safe dialogue where normally science is a dialogue, not a fact or a fixed endpoint. And I'm just curious of how's everyone responding? Because you can lose your jobs. You can lose, you know, if you work for a certain hospital or healthcare system. And, you know, in Canada, the same thing has occurred. And worldwide, we've seen this, you know, we've got physicians speaking out, but, you know, people go, trust doctors, not that one, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's what you would expect, I guess. You have a lot of physicians and scientists that have refused to budge on their reality and speak their truth and are you know rooted in their knowingness of this, but they got shut down immediately, and so you know they are unable to voice their opinion. And so I have had to be very clear that I'm not anti-vax at all. I want an intelligent vaccine program that would help prevent disease in my grandchildren. But what I'm watching unfold is not a safe or effective approach to vaccination. So I'm not anti-vax. I'm anti-blind science. You know,
yeah.
We cannot
can we
write
all be that?
Blank checks to the pharmaceutical industry and say, put something on the market in the next 6 months and we won't hold you to any efficacy or safety standards. That can't happen. That is not scientific. That is not rational. That is not humane. And so that's what I'm against, is the process that's at hand. The science I'm all for. Let's figure out what the innate immune system of humanity looks like now that we've had the microbiome revolution. Now that we know that human health doesn't happen unless there's a huge, diverse microbiome within you. And then in the more recent discovery of the virome, of like this genomic pool of intelligence that we swim within, it's not against us, it's for us. So now let's re-understand human physiology, not against nature, not opposed to nature, but within our natural design. That's the vaccination program we need in the next couple of years, is given what we now know about the microbiome and the virome, what is the intelligent approach to developing homeostasis or balance with the viruses and bacteria in you and around you? Certainly, it's no longer to sterilize you. That's what we thought up until, you know, really until the last decade or two. Physicians just thought bacteria were bad invaders to the body. We now know that the opposite is true. The bacteria are literally nursemaiding your body into health every day. And if you don't have that organic garden, diverse ecosystem within you, your immune system doesn't work. Your cancer rates go up. Your heart disease rates go up. Your mood disorders go skyrocketing. Sleep falls apart. Chronic pain sets in. You know, the whole American syndrome is there. We need this new concept of human health in which the human cell no longer sits at the center of the model. We need to realize that Mother Earth in her biodiversity sits at the center of human health. And once we embrace that change in relationship, once we embrace our humble role within this matrix of life on Earth, we will imagine a much different vaccine program. And so I've got, you know, on change.org, I've got a petition to scientists and physicians and the rest to sign the petition that says, we need to reevaluate, we need to re-ask the questions about the innate immune system now that we know about the microbiome and the virome. We need a different approach. And so I'm all for being part of the future vaccine industry that puts itself in line with Mother Nature instead of in opposition to it, seeks balance with the microbiome instead of conflict with the microbiome, seeks balance with the viruses of the respiratory system rather than conflict with them. We will find a pathway into that. The science is really cool. If we start building resources within nutrients in our food, our vaccine program could actually be delivered through nutritious food instead of through syringes in the arm.
That's
our nutrients within our food could be engineered through good soil management, through good farm practices, through the rest, to have exactly the right mycelial intelligence from the fungi within those soils that would imbue that food with the antiviral components that have long been there. And we just engineered it out of our food through this, you know, last few decades of chemical warfare against our food and nutrition sources. So that's the excitement that I have, is we need to broaden our definition of vaccines. And maybe that's the silver lining of this pandemic and our response to it, is we just broadened our definition of vaccines.
Yeah.
Now it's genetic modification is included in the definition of vaccination. And so now we need to modify that behavior one more time and say, what if vaccination actually means supporting the innate immune system's response to these viruses instead of putting the innate immune system in vicious, you know, opposition to all of these viruses? These viruses have a role, and we know they do because they've always been part of the human experience and they allowed us to occur.
What a fascinating perspective of working in unison with the way nature already works, you know, and that's not a leap. You know, I'm curious, you know, we hear a lot of dialogue about variants, and just like to, because I imagine most people are like, oh my God, a variant of concern. That's very much a group of words that triggers the amygdala for sure. So I'm curious just if you could express a little more of how maybe viruses work and the immune system works in unison and to handle those variants.
Very good. Yeah. So viruses are a step up in adaptation capacity of biology. Before the viruses, we had something called horizontal gene transfer. And the way in which bacteria back, you know, 3.5 billion years ago did this, and they still do it today, is to bump into each other. And as soon as they approach each other, they can swap genetic information through these little envelope packages, and they swap them back and forth and can quickly do adaptation for biologic benefit. And interestingly, they're not selfish about gain of function, you know, whereas our laboratories that are doing gain of function viral research, they're always trying to patent some new gain of function. So they're going to patent this as potential chemical warfare agent, or they're going to patent it as something else. But they're always, biology has never done that with genetic modification. It's always looked to share genetic gain. And so as soon as gain of function was discovered by a bacteria 3.5 billion years ago, it would immediately swap it to all of its surrounding bacteria of species. It didn't matter. They just wanted this new genetic information out there. So they did this to this horizontal gene transfer mechanism. During that process, there was an opportunity to actually absorb not just the genetic information of a nearby bacteria, but ingest an entire bacterium and all of its genetic information. And so that created the first plant plastid, or the first mitochondria ultimately, for human cells. And these became the power plants. The emergence of these double bacterial intelligence systems, two bacteria in one, with different mechanisms of action, allowed us to shift from fermentation energy production to respiratory and oxygen-based energy production. And that is a 10x leap in energy production. So that's what allowed multicellular organisms to occur, is they needed to be able to produce much more energy than a single bacteria. And they did it by this adaptive biologic swapping that was kind of this genetic transfer mechanism that allowed this to happen. Now what happens is, inside of each of my human cells, I keep a population of these tiny little bacteria called mitochondria that are a double-walled bacteria with a lot of interesting circular DNA, which is viral programs. So all viruses carry a circular genome, or the vast majority of them do. And that's what the mitochondrial DNA looks like, is all this viral genomic information packed inside these little bacteria that live inside my cells, and they reproduce. And I inherited all of my mitochondria bacteria from my mother. Dad's sperm dumps its mitochondria before it infuses its nuclear DNA into the ovum to fertilize the first cell of the human. And so mom populates this organic garden of bacterial guys with all this viral information. And interestingly, in these last few years, we've come to find out that there's a constant swapping of information genetically between the microbiome inside your cells and your nuclear DNA, which would go on to reproduce your body, whether it would be a kidney cell or a first, you know, embryonic cell that's dividing to go make that embryo. We can do swapping of information between the mitochondria, which is little bacteria with viral genomics, to that human 46 chromosomes that you inherited from mom and dad. They're swapping information all the time.
Wow.
And so what I'm trying to paint you a picture of is when we start to talk about viruses, we're really talking about genetic communication. And at the beginning, it started with just this ability. You had to bump into the nearby cell to transmit that information onto the population. The advent of bacteriophage and viruses was that these packets of information began to take on traits that allowed them to travel long distances. And so suddenly you could get a genetic update to biology, and you could send it out into the air around the organism and pass that information on very quickly to large populations. And this was a extraordinary boost in the acceleration of life diversification on the planet Earth. And so the amount of life, you know, changed between 3.5 billion years ago and 3 billion years ago, almost nothing. But suddenly, as we started to get more and more viral communication capacity within the organisms of the world, we were able to gain a function and adaptation and biodiversification all of the time at this accelerating rate. And so we developed, you know, by 55 million years ago, we had dinosaurs and massive ferns the size of houses and, you know, soil that was so vibrant with microbial life that we can't even imagine at this point. And then a big extinction event happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the big extinction event didn't wipe out life on Earth. It wiped out 87% to 97%, depending on which of the extinctions you look at. We've had 5 big extinctions on the planet. But that last one is so curious to me, because if I was Mother Earth and I created the dinosaurs, I'd be pretty pleased with that. What a cool invention that was biologically. I love the dinosaurs. What kid doesn't love the dinosaurs? You got Triceratops and the pterodactyls and all these cool animals. Yeah. But it's so interesting that Mother Earth never looked back at that event and said, we need to struggle back to make the dinosaurs again. Instead, right. It created birds and mammals. And the intelligence of the planet increased, and it developed deciduous trees and flowering plants that did not exist before the previous extinction. Well, how did that occur? It happened because of the viruses. And so viruses are not living beings. They're just genetic information packets. And when you put an organism under stress, it needs to do more adaptation to see if it can get out from underneath the stress.
Mm-hmm.
But extinction level stress on all of the organisms of the Earth, they're going to create so much adaptive information that's then stored in the viral genome that's in the ocean water. It's in the air. There's 10 to the 31 viruses in the air, which is 10 million times more than our stars in the entire universe. I mean, these numbers are so gigantuan. So we're in this ocean or this, you know, stew of viruses in the air. There's another 10 to the 31 in the seawater. There's another 10 to the 30 viruses in the soil beneath our feet. We are in these galactic universes of genetic information. And every time you put an extinction event on the planet, life bursts out more intelligently, more diverse because of the adaptation that happens under stress to biology. And so as we approach the 6th great extinction, we have an interesting equation of, we can certainly march the rest of the planet and ourselves into extinction. No problem. Just keep doing what we're doing. Keep ordering everything on Amazon. Keep buying stuff. You're already participating brilliantly in this great extinction event, which is a huge explosion of genetic information on the planet. And we can call them pandemics, we can call them whatever, but literally it's just biology looking for an escape mechanism to an extinction event.
Hmm.
On the back end of this, can you imagine what organisms come after birds, dolphins, humans? What are the organisms of Earth that are that much more intelligent, going from reptiles of dinosaurs to humans, birds, and dolphins? What is the next leap of genetic information that we are creating right now under our extinction level stress on the planet? That's super exciting to me. I would love to be around in 100 million years to see what's here.
Right.
That'd be pretty fascinating. But what if we stopped in the midst of this extinction event We've now created huge amounts of stress in human biology and otherwise all over the planet. We've lost some 50% of life on Earth over the last 40, 50 years. So we're halfway through the great extinction event. What if we stopped our behavior over the next decade? What if we just changed everything? What if we re-engineered everything to be in line with nature instead of opposed to nature? Our transportation industry, our communications networks, our 5G towers. What if we started demanding that 5G towers had to emit biologically optimizing frequencies of resonance if they were going to exist at all? So that the 5G towers actually were propagating life rather than opposing life. That would be super cool. Like, it's same technology used completely differently, in line with nature instead of against nature. What if we said, okay, genetic modification, all this CRISPR technology of gene editing, super interesting, but instead of genetically modifying our plants and food so that they can handle toxins that then end up in our food, what if we genetically modify and use CRISPR to actually increase the ability of plants to absorb nutrients that fought viruses? And so we genetically modified our food to be more nutrient dense, more nutrient intelligent, so that we never had a pandemic again. We could do that. We can use CRISPR to do that. We can use 5G to do that. We can use these things for great good. We choose not to because there's not short-term gains. We need to create a long ball vision for where we're going as humanity, and we need to start to innovate in that direction. And right now, the entire financial system from stem to stern are built on short-term gains because it was built in a masculine archetype. The masculine archetype is goal-oriented, short-term, win the game, win the war, whatever it is, but you fail to see the forest for the trees. The feminine archetype is not goal-oriented, it's actually process-oriented. And so if we back up for a moment and said, humanity, we're going to let go of the Western paradigm of the masculine archetype of goal-oriented fiscal policy, finance, investment strategies, you know, venture capital, all these things. We're going to reimagine that into a process. And we're going to start building investment vehicles that allow for a long ball, 10, 20-year process to be put in place that would encourage industries as big as the food system, as big as the agriculture industry, to come in line with Mother Nature and co-create with her instead of be opposed to her. Instead of being extractive, it would be co-creative. Mm-hmm. And we already know how to do that at the farming level. We haven't built the financial models to allow the farmers to do that because we are incentivizing them financially to only do this one thing over here, which is grow as much genetically modified corn as possible. And so if we change our incentives and bring our incentives financially in line with a feminine archetype of, we need a process-oriented belief system that nature knows how to create life, and we need to start to work within that to be co-creators of life rather than extractors of it, we would change the world so quickly. And we would have extinction-level intelligence within the virome to see what would happen next. And we could actually be witness to the next explosion of life and biodiversity of the planet. Wouldn't that be a beautiful thing to pass on to our children?
Isn't that interesting to think that the pressure on life today that you're speaking about could be this invitation to a collaborative approach that expands consciousness, nutrition, all these things that we are like aiding, and the consciousness or the intelligence that's about aiding is actually what contributes to the more intelligent life. I love that. You know, in what you said about if you in some way help the plants absorb more nutrients, we would benefit from that. And instead, we seem to be removing nutrients from food, calling it, you know, a burger, when it's really just a pile of lab created, you know, it's not intelligent food. And I mean, you're speaking to, I love the beauty of the what's possible. And I think we always have to hold on to what's possible. And at the same time, there's this sort of bridge between there is something that has to die in order for that to be born. And, you know, I get scared of the level of inability to even hear anything that opposes the common narrative, and recognizing like how much that affects our biology, this inability to hear discourse, this inability to maybe even feel the hope that you're inviting into us.
We need the journey is one interesting thing, right? And so, you know, it's easy for me to get extremely frustrated about what's happened in the last year.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I get a good night's sleep and I wake up and go walk in the woods and get some time out in the ocean, I come away with the experience and the reality of, we're walking the human story. this is it. This is part of the human story now, is that in 2020, we decided that it was reasonable to genetically modify a vast amount of our population against a single viral protein without any evidence that it would be work or be safe or anything. And we just did that. All right. So
my own family members are here for
these vaccines. So it's not like I've convinced anybody. I haven't even convinced my own family members that they should question this thing. So I have completely failed to bring any level of, you know, change, as far as I can tell. And so I'm not here to create change. I'm here to ask questions at this point of what could it be other than what we have right now. And we needed the path that we had, I think, to let the pendulum swing finally to that level of extremity where we let the pharmaceutical companies do everything. Yeah. We just outsourced life to them and we said, we're going to trust you guys. You know what? Here's all the money that the Fed can print. We're now $4 trillion into printing money in the last 11 months. So $4 trillion, and we can print money at will. So just keep doing what you're doing. We trust you to solve this. We had to walk that walk. As a species, we're going to have to lose faith in the chemical industries to create clean technology for transportation, to do anything. We have to stop trusting that they have our interests at heart. The pharmaceutical companies are hard to understand. It seems like they're in the health industry, but how could they possibly put drugs on the market that kill people? Well, they do every single day. That's hard to reconcile in the human mind. And I think that ultimately we don't change unless we see the reality for what it is. And so in this extraordinary way, you know, we have to do the pendulum swing because humans don't adapt easily to new ways of thinking. So what is the path we've walked? Where are we right now? Where we are right now, if I take the viewpoint of scientists, is that we are in the midst of the largest philosophical revolution in history of science right now in the last 10 years. And to paint that picture, I would point to 2,000 years ago when Pythagoras, an incredible mathematician out of Greece, suddenly realized the planet wasn't flat. And he came out with all of these incredible scientific proofs that the world was actually a sphere. That was so disruptive to human thought that here we are 2,000 years later and we have a very vibrant flat Earth society. And so after 2,000 years, we still haven't convinced the world that the world is actually a sphere. Humans are really holding on to the belief that maybe this is still flat. And especially when they see government agencies insisting that it is a sphere without really showing any data or knowing science or anything else. Everybody's like, it is a circle. It is a sphere. Well, that's not reassuring to anybody who's lost faith in their government. And so I understand what's fueling the flat Earth society is this kind of group doubt or doubt of government authority or scientific narratives. I think we deserve that level of skepticism, frankly, because we haven't done a good job of allowing narratives and discourse to happen. Where we are now, though, is, you know, 1600 years after the discovery that the planet is a sphere, we find out from, you know, the discovery of the telescope that the Earth was not at the center of the solar system and that it wasn't actually the center of the galaxies and all the rest. And suddenly we were not the center of creation. And that was not only extremely disruptive to science, it was disruptive to religion. And so we suddenly had to go down this pathway of, well, what if there's other planets out there then? And what if there's other people out there? Like, you know, is this existential thing that's challenged us religiously and spiritually? I thought we were the penultimate invention of life within the universe, and God has made man for this thing. And we had all these narratives and we continue to struggle with those today, 400 years later. And then in the last 10 years, telescope becomes a new technology, which is a genomics sequencer, a genome sequencer. And when you can genetically sequence an organism like a human and find out that we hardly exist outside of the viral data within us, it suddenly puts not humans at the center of the human life experience. It puts the microbiome at the center. And so how much more disruptive is it to say that humans aren't the center of humanity? Humans aren't actually the center of human consciousness. Humans are an amalgamation of biology on the planet that is expressing its collective intelligence, its collective consciousness through this human experiment, through this human moment that we're in. That's only 200,000 years, this brief split second in the history of the planet is expressing itself human right now. But that human expression is not centered on human biology. In fact, it's the biology of your soil under your feet and the food that you would ingest that's defining that human experience much more so than anything you receive from mom and dad genetically. And so you are the amalgamation of Mother Nature herself in your ability to have consciousness right now.
Wow.
And so what a fascinating, necessary journey for us to take. And if we have to go into extinction now, that's okay, because we made this paradigm leap forward in the ability of biology to hold consciousness. And you can see that in the difference of, you know, a deer that's running through the and running on instinct alone to, you know, a monkey that starts to have a much different concept of self and a much different ability to interact with its surroundings and community and all of that with a different mindset. And so we can see these higher orders of biology march along, and then you get Homo sapiens, and the Homo sapiens have the ability to not only imagine themselves within a community, they're imagining other universes, they're imagining gods, they're imagining, you know, angels and demons. And we've come up with all of these extraordinary abstract concepts around the human experience that are invisible to us, but we have held these beliefs of angels and demons and deities for thousands and thousands of years within humanity. So what we have now proven is we can advance biology on planet Earth to be able to hold abstract consciousness and behave according to that abstract, you know, belief system. So now what happens when you take another iteration leap from dinosaur to human to whatever comes next? We've contributed, perhaps. Perhaps we've walked the human journey we needed to walk. And so my children that showed up and are now young adults, my grandchildren that will show up, my offspring, you know, 100 years down the road at the end of humankind, or 10,000 years at the birth of a new humanity, they're all going to show up on purpose. And if that purpose was to come to this penultimate point of extinction with the level of consciousness that we had derived up until that moment, that is still a high purpose. And this is what I find in my hospice work every day, is that when somebody's given that terminal diagnosis or you got 6 months to live, they start living their life completely differently than they ever have before. Yeah. And that's fascinating. Yes. And so when I tell humanity, hey, all the scientists are pointing into something phenomenal in the agricultural community, which is there's only 60 harvests left on Earth, period. And by the way, the human biologists have come up with a reality that in 80 to 100 years, humans are extinct. Well, you just got put on hospice, humanity.
Right.
Homo sapiens sapiens, you just entered your hospice moment. This is the end. This is the end of humanity as we know it. It's the end of the planet as we've known it. And so now, how do we change our behavior?
Yeah.
And is this hospice moment exactly what we needed to change that behavior so that we go out highly conscious? Because it's one of the most beautiful things I witnessed is humans going out at their highest vibration. And that last few months, weeks, and even hours of their life, they are bespoke with the highest wisdom. They have the most extraordinary energetic interactions with their loved ones, with their family members, etc. So much beauty can pour out of that. And so if that's how we go out, beautiful, perfect, it should happen. Or if we transform and come into alignment with nature to find out that humanity does not need to go extinct, and we can actually become the most generative, co-creative species that's ever been on the planet, and we can, in just 200 short years, turn this into a Garden of Eden. We could reforest North Africa and the Sahara. We could reforest, you know, the deserts of South America and Central America. We could reforest this planet into the most vibrant, diverse, species-embracing planet that exists in many solar systems and galaxies around us and all the rest. We could become that vibrant hub that is so much more vibrant than anything we've seen before. So that's what we could do with our hospice moment. The only equation that really frightens me and makes me really heartbroken is the possibility that we instead, in our hospice moment, where every single year more chronic disease happens, more cancer happens in our children, more autoimmune disease happens in our young people, more mood disorders, more suicides, more homicides, more anger, more war, and we turn more and more of the pain over to the pharmaceutical companies that will happily make more and more narcotics for us to drug ourselves into oblivion, that's the end point I fear. And so I don't actually oppose the possibility of extinction. I'm afraid that we move into it in such a drugged up stupor that we don't contribute to the higher consciousness of the next iteration of life on this planet. And so my hope is that we shake each other awake in this hospice moment and say, let's stop the drugs. Let's not focus on preserving, you know, more years of life. And let's look at quality of life. Let's look at rising our vibrational perception of the world around us and the universe around us such that we would call in new life on this planet, life more diverse, perhaps certainly more intelligent. Let's go there and be in that high conscious state where we're calling in a future that might or might not include humanity, but definitely is in a higher state of beauty and coherence and less of this extractive, destructive, oppositional behavior that we've expressed as a species. We need to end that. That needs to end before we wipe out so much beauty. And so let's do it awake, whatever we do next. Let's not allow the pharmaceutical companies to palliate us into a drugged up state of stupor that we don't even realize the stew that we're sitting in. And so if we need to go extinct, I'm okay with that. Death is a beautiful thing. It's a rebirth. And we've seen that on the planet as much as we've seen that in single individuals. It is a rebirth. The last Global Health Education Summit we just did on death, dying, and rebirth. If you missed that one, please go tune into that. It was mind-blowing beauty. Five physicians and five healthcare providers, from death doulas to neurosurgeons, expressing their experiences around death and dying that will completely change your viewpoint of death. I guarantee it. You will not walk away from that 2 hours the same person. So dive into that. The month before that, we did What Happened Last Year, which was a three-hour piece on 95 different science, published peer-reviewed science journal articles on what actually happened during the pandemic. And this month, we're doing genetically modified organisms, and we're doing a deep dive on the science of GMO foods, GMO pigs, salmons, and GMO humans. And now that we have this new quote-unquote vaccine program going. So we're taking a look at genetic modification as a deep dive. But of all of those, I would start at the death and dying piece, because when you lose the fear of death, then this whole discussion around extinction and are we going to die, all that, instead just starts to ask the cooler question of what are we going to become on the backside of that? What are we going to rebirth on the backside of human death, whether it be my death from coronavirus or my death from cancer or my death from extinction of the planet? What do I want to be a part of rebirthing on the other side of that? And those are the questions that I think we have to do, because those will be the transformative, paradigm shifting, behavior shifting questions and answers that we will go after. If we keep asking what is the next vaccine to the next virus that appears, we can't compete. There's 10 to the 31 viruses. There's 10 to the 31 viruses. There's no way we can biologically advance, enough genetic modification to change your behavior to all those 10 to the 31 viruses. And so that is an impossible game to play. Being against nature is impossible. She's too big. She's too intelligent. She's got billions of years of experience that predates our 10 years of experience with CRISPR. And so we are idiots in the world of genetic engineering. This planet has been genetically engineering the potential for life since its origin. We need to bow to that intelligence that's been born out from billions of years of experiments. And we are the result of the most recent experiment. And it's beautiful. We are beautiful if we stop behaving the way that we do. And we have huge potential. We have huge potential as a species. And we can realize that in our death and rebirth, or we can realize it by simply changing our behavior and humbling ourselves before this extraordinary nature that we live within, the extreme beauty that has been imbued and endowed upon this earth by some consciousness, by some ordered biology that is much greater than this planet, that is much greater than humanity and our brief history. We need to bow to it. We need to become extremely humble to the extreme intelligence of the design of nature and start to behave within it.
I mean, amen to all of that. The invitation to harmony, to reverence, to curiosity, to not avoid suffering, but rather sit with it and ask it questions and recognize that all of this is part of the miracle that is this, even this conversation occurring in two different parts of the world through the magic that has been created on this planet. Zach, just to honor your time and all the things, I did want to finish just with asking about, because I take it every day, but the Ion Biome, just to let people know a little bit about it and how it works and how that could be an invitation back in some small way, right, or big way.
Yeah, so the science behind this product is really what brought me to my current you know, capacity to have the discourse that we just had. I did not have this worldview 10 years ago when I was designing chemotherapy at the University of Virginia. I was of the opposite viewpoint that I was going to be a part of a technological advancement that would engineer cancer out of the human experience. But it was a daunting day. It was somewhat of an embarrassing, but definitely heartbreaking day when I realized that there had never been a single case of cancer in the history of mankind that had been caused by a lack of chemotherapy. And so I suddenly in that moment realized no matter how smart or good I got at making new non-toxic, less toxic versions of chemotherapy, I would never prevent a single case of cancer. And that was a very discouraging reality to step into. It was a death point for my pharmaceutical model of health because I realized that the same could be asked for any heart attack that had ever been had. No heart attack has ever been caused by a lack of Lipitor, you know? Right. And so I was going down the wrong path, literally. I could not come to a beneficial endpoint for humanity in that pharmaceutical model. And so in that moment, my world changed. And the only thing I could figure out to live up to my Hippocratic Oath at that point was nutrition. And so as an endocrinologist at the time, you know, dealing with a ton of diabetics and all this, I had done a lot of diabetes nutrition education, which meant like, you know, eat more protein, eat less carbohydrates. You know, we were just so mixed up in our beliefs about nutrition and diabetes alone. But I had started to go down that avenue and I'd had a couple of doctors really shake up my world of understanding nutrition. And Neil Barnard being a great example of it, wrote a book called Reversing Diabetes. I had never known that you could reverse diabetes. I was an endocrinologist trained at the third best endocrine program in the world. A diabetes specialist didn't know you could reverse type 2 diabetes in the course of a couple months. And so that was a huge revelation to me. And so that had started me down the nutrition pathway. And so as I left the university and the whole chemotherapy development world, I decided I would start a nutrition center for reversing chronic disease through food. And so in that journey, we started to practice extreme levels of nutrient delivery. So we were juicing literally pounds of kale for our cancer patients every day. We were just, you know, trying to turn our patients green and orange with kale and carrots that we were force feeding them. And in that journey, came to an extraordinary realization that the food that we were feeding them no longer had the medicine within it. We were doing exactly what Campbell and everybody was doing in the 1970s to great success, and it wasn't working anymore. And so that took me into nutrient density and ultimately into agriculture to find out why the food wasn't working anymore, which took me into this incredible world of soil science. And that's where we discovered the science that would become Ion Biome as a product line. Ion is a family of molecules that are made by bacteria and fungi in the soil and when they metabolize nutrients. And so when the microbiome eats, it creates a communication network as a result. And the communication network tells the entire organism of life within the soil or within your body what to do with that energy. And so it's a very brilliant model of how the world and of nature works. Is not only does it figure out how to use energy in the digestion of that energy, it produces an information stream as to how to best utilize that for repair, regeneration of the organisms that would consume the downstream food. And so that's what we discovered within soil and then ultimately within the human gut. In 2013, we launched the company, which at the time was, the product was called Restore. And we were simply extracting all of this intelligence out of fossil soils to put into the human experience. And I say simply, it's a little bit complex on how to get these carbon molecules out of fossil soils and all that. But it didn't take long before we were getting pretty proficient. Now our facility is night and day compared to where we were 7 years ago. And we're able to do this in an extraordinary capacity of taking these huge volumes of fossil soils and extracting massive amounts of information out of these soils. And we put those into liquid supplements that can be delivered, in the case of our first gut product, in the form of a liquid supplement before each meal. And it would inform your body how to accelerate the repair process and regenerative process, not because it was telling the body to do anything. This was the first supplement that actually does nothing to the body. Instead, it coordinates the body's natural response to food and nutrition. And so when you put this in before food, you see an acceleration of protein synthesis from the human body. You see acceleration of immune antioxidant reservoirs being built. You see this whole acceleration of life happen, not because the product is doing that, but because it's facilitating the communication between the cells of the human body and informing it how to use the energy from food at to the organism's highest benefit. So it's a really cool way of harnessing the communication network of the microbiome for human health. And so that's what's really evolved to my understanding that human health is not centered upon the human cell at all. The human mm-hmm. cell is only there in response to the intelligence of the nature that it dwells within. And that's exactly what our product has proved out over time. We launched the science product some years back, and it became one of the fastest growing products in the natural sector because it turns out the sinuses, like your gut, tend to leak a lot when we're exposed to chemicals. So alcohol, probably the oldest chemical that damaged the barrier system of your nasosinuses and gut. But the chemicals of today's food system, the Roundup and glyphosate and gluten, refined gluten products, all of these damage these barrier systems, causing leak, causing reactivity to our environment. So we get allergies to seasonal allergies. We get allergies to our food, food sensitivities. All of that is due to the leak of these barrier systems. And when you put the communication network of the microbiome back in place with ION, you get this rapid reorientation of that's outside, this is inside, and the immune system doesn't have to do the heavy lifting of reacting to everything anymore. You have intelligent barriers put back together, the tight junctions zipper back together, the nasal epithelium and the gut. In this summer of 2021, I'm very excited to be launching the Beauty From Within campaign. We have been working for years to create our skin fortification spray sprays onto the skin. It has a completely different way of working with the keratinocytes than any skin product ever has. It encourages the keratinocytes to not only create a solid barrier against the chemicals in the water of the shower you're taking in, but probably more importantly, the chemicals that are in the cosmetics you're putting on your skin, from the lotions to the sunscreen to the makeup that you're wearing. There's 160 to 180 different chemicals that are carcinogenic that are typical in the daily experience of cosmetics. If you have a keratinocyte tight junction barrier, you get less of those into the bloodstream. You end up with less toxicity to the organism. So we're very excited to fortify the natural health of the skin. Excitingly, we've also shown that it actually creates an adaptive effect to the sun. So when you go out to get that vitamin D, instead of doing a stress response, your body goes into an anabolic repair process. So these are the exciting things that we recognize, that if we were had the intact skin microbiome, we wouldn't have the sunburns, we wouldn't have the skin cancers and everything else, because our repair rate would be so high. And it's pretty obvious that humans ultimately developed in the context of the sun. We must have had the skin intelligence to be able to stay out in the sun all day long before we had houses, before we had sunscreen, before we wore all of these synthetic fiber clothing to block the sun off of our skin. We dwelt without skin cancer before any of that happened. And so the natural innate intelligence of the skin is being reinformed by the skin fortification spray that we've got coming out. So it's very exciting.
Cool. That's really exciting.
This product environment where we're not doing anything to you. We're simply unleashing your potential as the innate, intelligent human biology that you are. And that's what gets me excited every time somebody new reaches for a bottle they've never touched, because the intelligence they're touching, as soon as they pick that up, is from 55 million years ago. The soil has not recovered since the dinosaurs. We have never had the same level of intelligence back on this planet yet. Maybe after this next extinction, we get there. But right now, when you reach for a bottle of ION, you're reaching for a level of microbial intelligence that humans, only 200,000 years in existence, have never touched before. Wow. And so it's been a real honor to be part of a product that is literally tying us back to an ancestral intelligence on this planet that predates humanity by millions of years. And that's humbling. And it's been humbling to see its impact on. We've spent a lot of time with children with autism and other conditions, watching them start to reintegrate nature into their systems and express their highest self. I can tell you that the autistic kids in our world today are the angels among us. These are the most intelligent, most high consciousness entities I've ever been around. And they get to start to reintegrate biology in them. They do great things. They do great things. And so I'm excited that the autism epidemic, the pandemic, the death of humanity is preparing us for a moment that we could actually change our behavior and reintegrate into nature to express our highest self. And when we do that, we will not even recognize the humanity that will come out of that moment.
Well, thank you. I'm so grateful to have had your voice on here, your wisdom, your experience, and your gift. I mean, your intention is carried in your words, and I just really appreciate the exchange of time for this and to share with the listener.
I'm so honored to be back on with you. I appreciate the space you hold for me and all of your guests that so advance the human dialogue. So thank you for keeping us in dialogue as humanity. And thanks for being part of that incredible new technology of podcasting that keeps us having conversation together. It's the most precious of human rights. And if we let this civil liberty of conversation be taken away from us, it will be the end of our empire for sure. And so humanity will collapse when we stop valuing communication, when we stop valuing different viewpoints. And so thank you for inviting me on to hear a different viewpoint and to embrace it.
Yeah, of course. And curious for the people listening, where do they find you? Where do they, we'll put the links in the show notes, and where do they find the beautiful products that you were speaking of?
Yeah, ZachBushMD.com is the website. It'll take you to the whole universe of what's happening in and around me. The Ion products can be found on that page. You can also go to the Ion website, which is ionbiome.com. But at the Zach Bush MD page, you're going to want to go there for all the education stuff. So our global health education seminars that happen every month, they're free. They've been fully supported by donations only, which I'm really excited about. So there's no paywall between you and all of this science information. The global community has been really generous. So join us monthly. Every month we have, you know, between 20 and 30,000 people join us for these things. And so join us for the next event. I promise we'll continue to push the envelope of allowing you to feel more hope for who you are. You showed up right now at the tipping point of all of humanity on purpose. And we're here to empower that purpose with more information and a science primer on what it means to be alive today.
Amen. Thank you, sir. Appreciate you. Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode. If this episode resonated with you, one of the best ways to support the show is to go subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any more. Leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to it, or share the episode with your community on Instagram or whatever social place you like to hang out. This helps get it into more people's ears, and I'm so grateful for your support always. Thanks again for tuning in. Much love.